Ah had asked, "Have you talked to God about this, Jodotha?" And Jody, right back at you, good ma. "It was Don Cloutier got me in the family way, not God." That was when Dad left the table and his favorite daughter behind, without a word or a backward look. A few moments later, Lisi had heard the sound of his radio coming from the barn, very faint. 3 weeks later, he'd had the first of his strokes. Now Jody's gone, although not yet to Miami, that is years in the future, and it's Lisi who bears the brunt of Darla's outraged calls, little Lisi, and why? Because Canty is on Darla's side, and calling Jody does neither of them any good. Jody is different from the other DeBuscher girls. Darla calls her cold, Canty calls her selfish, and they both call her uncaring. But Lisi thinks it's something else, something better and finer. Of the five girls, Jody is the one true survivor, completely immune to the fumes of guilt rising from the old family teepee. Once Granny Dee generated those fumes, then their mother. But Darla and Canty stand ready to take over, already understanding that if you call that poisonous, addictive smoke duty, nobody tells you to put the fire out. As for Lisi, she only wishes she were more like Jody, that when Darla calls, she could laugh and say, "Blow it out your ass, Darla, darling. You made your bed, so go on and sleep in it." 15. Standing in the kitchen doorway, looking into the long, sloping backyard, wanting to see him come walking back out of the darkness, wanting to holler him back, yes, more than ever, but stubbornly holding his name behind her lips, she waited for him all evening. She will wait a little longer, but only a little. She's beginning to be so frightened. 16. Dandy's radio is strictly AM. WGUY's a sundowner and long off the air, but WDER was playing the oldies when she rinsed her wine glass, some 50s hero singing about young love, and went back into the living room and bingo, there he was, standing in the doorway with a can of beer in one hand and his slanted smile on his face. Probably she hadn't heard the sound of his Ford pulling up because of the music, or the beat of her headache, or both. "Hey, Lisi," he said. "Sorry I'm late. Really sorry. A bunch of us from David's Honor Seminar got arguing about Thomas Hardy and..." She turned away from him without a word and went back into the kitchen, back to the sound of the Philco. Now it was a bunch of guys singing Shaboom. He followed her. She knew he would follow her. It was how these things went. She could feel all the things she had to say to him crowding up in her throat, acid things, poison things, and some lonely, terrified voice told her not to say them, not to this man. And she slang that voice away. In her anger, she could do nothing else. He cocked a thumb at the radio and said, stupidly proud of his useless knowledge, "That's the chords, the original black version." She turned to him and said, "Do you think I give a rat's ass who's singing on the radio after I worked 8 hours and waited for you another 5? And you finally show up at 11:15 with a grin on your face and a beer in your hand and a story about how some dead poet ended up being more important to you than I am?" The grin on his face was still there, but it was getting smaller, fading until it was little more than a quirk and one shallow dimple. Water, meanwhile, had risen in his eyes. The lost, scared voice tried to call its warning again, and she ignored it. This was a cutting party now. In both the fading grin and the growing hurt in his eyes, she saw how he loved her, and knew this increased her power to hurt him. Still, she would cut. And why? Because she could. Standing in the kitchen door and waiting for him to come back, she can't remember all the things she said, only that each one was a little worse, a little more perfectly tailored to hurt. At one point she was appalled to hear how much she sounded like Darla at her worst. Just one more hectoring DeBuscher, and by then his smile was no longer even hanging in there. He was looking at her solemnly, and she was terrified by how large his eyes were, magnified by the wetness shimmering on their surfaces until they seemed to eat up his face. She stopped in the middle of something about how his fingernails were always dirty and he gnawed on them like a rat when he was reading. She stopped, and at that moment there were no engine sounds from in front of the Shamrock and the mill downtown, no screeching tires, not even the faint sound of this weekend's band playing at the Rock. The silence was enormous, and she realized she wanted to go back and had no idea how to do it. The simplest thing, "I love you anyway, Scott, come to bed," will not occur to her until later, not until after the Bool. "Scott, I..." She had no idea where to go from there, and it seemed there was no need. Scott raised the forefinger of his left hand like a teacher who means to make a particularly important point, and the smile actually resurfaced on his lips. Some sort of smile, anyway. "Wait," he said. "Wait?" He looked pleased, as if she had grasped a difficult concept. "Wait." And before she could say anything else, he simply walked off into the dark, back straight, walk straight, no drunk in him now, slim hips slinging in his jeans. She said his name once. "Scott?" But he only raised that forefinger again. "Wait." Then the shadows swallowed him. 17. Now she stands looking anxiously down the lawn. She has turned off the kitchen light, thinking that may make it easier to see him. But even with the help of the pole light in the yard next door, the shadows take over halfway down the hill. In the next yard, a dog barks hoarsely. That dog's name is Pluto. She knows because she has heard the people over there yelling at it from time to time. Fat lot of good it does. She thinks of the breaking glass sound she heard a minute ago. Like the barking, the breaking sounded close. Closer than the other sounds that populate this busy, unhappy night. Why, oh why, did she have to tee off on him like that? She didn't even want to see the stupid Swedish movie in the first place. And why had she felt such joy in it? Such mean and filthy joy? To that she has no answer. The late spring night breathes around her, and exactly how long has he been down there in the dark? Only 2 minutes? 5, maybe? Seems longer. And that sound of breaking glass, did that have anything to do with Scott? The greenhouse is down there. Parks. There's no reason that should make her heart beat faster, but it does. And just as she feels that increased rhythm, she sees motion beyond the place where her eyes lose their ability to see much of anything. A second later, the moving thing resolves itself into a man. She feels relief, but it doesn't dissipate her fear. She keeps thinking about the sound of breaking glass, and there's something wrong with the way he's moving. His limber, straight walk is gone. Now she does call his name, but what comes out is little more than a whisper. "Scott?" At the same time, her hand is scrabbling around on the wall, feeling for the switch that turns on the light over the stoop. Her call is low, but the shadowy figure plodding up the lawn, yes, that's a plod all right, not a walk, but a plod, raises its head just as Lisi's curious, numb fingers find the light switch and flick it. "It's a Bool, Lisi," he shouts as the light springs on. And could he have planned it better if he had stage-managed it? She thinks not. In his voice, she hears mad, jubilant relief, as if he has fixed everything. "And not just any Bool. It's a blood Bool." She has never heard the word before, but she doesn't mistake it for anything else, for boo or book or anything else. It's Bool, another Scott word, and not just any Bool, but a blood Bool. The kitchen light leaps down the lawn to meet him, and he's holding out his left hand to her like a gift. She's sure he means it as a gift, just as she's pretty sure there's still a hand under there someplace. Oh, pray to Jesus, Mary, and Jojo, the ever-loving carpenter, there's still a hand under there someplace, or he's going to be finishing the book he's working on, plus any that might come later, typing one-handed. Because where his left hand was, there's now just a red and dripping mass. Blood goes slipping between spread starfish things that she supposes are his fingers, and even as she flies to meet him, her feet stuttering down the back porch steps, she's counting those spread red shapes. 1, 2, 3, 4, oh thank God, that fifth one's the thumb. Everything's still there, but his jeans are splattered red, and still he holds his bloody lacerated hand out to her, the one he plunged through a pane of thick greenhouse glass, shouldering his way through the hedge at the foot of the lawn in order to get to it. Now he's holding out his gift to her, his act of atonement for being late, his blood Bool. It's for you, he says as she yanks off her blouse and drapes it around the red and dripping mass, feeling it soak through the cloth at once, feeling the crazy heat of it and knowing, of course, why that small voice was in such terror of the things she was saying to him, what it knew all along. Not only is this man in love with her, he's half in love with death, and more than ready to agree with every mean and hurtful thing anyone says about him. Anyone? No, not quite. He's not quite that vulnerable. Just anyone he loves. And Lisi suddenly realizes she's not the only one who has said almost nothing about her past. It's for you. To say I'm sorry I forgot, and it won't happen again. It's a bool. We... Scott, hush. It's all right. I'm not... We call it a blood bool. It's special. Daddy told me and Paul. I'm not mad at you. I was never mad at you. He stops at the foot of the splintery back steps, gawking at her. The expression makes him look about 10 years old. Her blouse is wrapped clumsily around his hand, like a knight's dress gauntlet. Once yellow, it's now all bloom and blood. She stands there on the lawn in her maiden-form bra, feeling the grass tickling her bare ankles. The dusky yellow light which rains on them from the kitchen puts a deep curved shadow between her breasts. Will you take it? He's looking at her with such childish pleading. All the man in him is gone for now. She sees pain in his long and longing glance and knows it's not from his lacerated hand, but she doesn't know what to say. This is beyond her. She's done well to get some sort of compress on the horrible mess he's made south of his wrist, but now she's frozen. Is there a right thing to say? More important, is there a wrong one? One that will set him off again? He helps her. If you take a bool, especially a blood bool, then sorry's okay. Daddy said so. Daddy told Paul and me over and over. Not told, but toll. He has regressed to the diction of his childhood. Oh, geez. Geez, Louise. Lisi says, I guess I take it then because I never wanted to go see any Swedish meatball movie with subtitles in the first place. My feet hurt. I just wanted to go to bed with you, and now look, we have to go to the smucking emergency room instead. He shakes his head slowly but firmly. Scott, if you weren't mad, why did you shout and call me all the bad gunky? All the bad gunky. Surely another postcard from his childhood. She notes it, puts it away for later examination. Because I couldn't shout at my sister anymore, she says. This hits her funny and she begins to laugh. She laughs hard and the sound so shocks her that she begins to cry. Then she feels lightheaded. She sits down on the porch steps, thinking she may faint. Scott sits beside her. He's 24. His hair falls almost to his shoulders. His face is scruffy with 2 days' growth, but he's as slim as a rule. On his left hand he wears her blouse, one sleeve now unwrapped and hanging down. He kisses the throbbing hollow of her temple, then looks at her with perfect fond understanding. When he speaks, he sounds almost like himself again. I understand, he says. Families suck. Yeah, they do, she whispers. He puts his arm around her, the left one, which she is already thinking of as the blood bull arm, his gift to her, his crazy smucked-up Friday night gift. They don't have to matter, he says. His voice is weirdly serene. It's as if he hasn't just turned his left hand into so much raw and bleeding meat. Listen, Lisi, people can forget anything. She looked at him doubtfully. Can they? Yes. This is our time now, you and me. That's what matters. You and me. But does she want that? Now that she sees how narrowly he's balanced? Now that she has a picture of what life with him may be like? Then she thinks of how his lips felt in the hollow of her temple, touching that special secret place, and she thinks, maybe I do. Doesn't every hurricane have an eye? Is it? She asks. For several seconds he says nothing, only holds her. From Cleve's paltry downtown come the sounds of engines and yells and wild whooping laughter. It's Friday night, and the Lost Boys are at play. But that is not here. Here is all the smell of her long, sloping backyard sleeping toward summer, the sound of Pluto barking under the pole light next door, and the feel of his arm around her. Even the warm, damp press of his wounded hand is comforting, marking the bare skin of her midriff like a brand. "Baby," he says at last, pauses, then, "baby love." For Lisi DeBuscher, 22, weary of her family and equally tired of being on her own, it is enough. Finally enough. He has hollered her home, and in the dark she gives in to the Scot of him. From then until the end, she will never look back. 18. When they're in the kitchen again, she unwinds her blouse and sees the damage. Looking at it, she feels another wave of faintness first lift her up toward the bright overhead light, and then drop her toward darkness. She has to struggle to stay conscious, and manages to do it by telling herself, "He needs me. He needs me to drive him to the ER at Dairy Home." He has somehow missed slicing into the veins which lie so close under the wrist, a blue-eyed miracle. But the palm is cut in at least 4 different places, some of the skin is hanging like wallpaper, and 3 of what her dad called the fat fingers are also cut. The piece de resistance is a horrible gash on his forearm with a triangle of thick green glass sticking up from it like a shark fin. She hears herself make a helpless, "ugh," sound as he pulls it out, almost casually, and tosses it into the trash. He holds her blood-soaked blouse under his hand and arm as he does this, considerately trying to keep blood off her kitchen floor. He does get a few drops on the lino, but there's surprisingly little to clean up later. There's a high counter stool that she sometimes sits on when she's peeling veggies, or even when she's washing dishes. When you're on your feet 8 hours a day, you take your sit-downs where you can get them. And Scott hooks it over with one foot so he can sit with his hand dripping into the sink. He says he's going to tell her what to do. "You have to go to the ER," she tells him. "Scott, be sensible. Hands are full of tendons and things. Do you want to lose the use of it? Because you could. You really could. If you're worried about what they'll say, you can cook up some story. Cooking up stories is what you do, and I'll back you." "If you still want me to go tomorrow, we'll go," he tells her. Now he's entirely his normal self, rational and charming and almost hypnotically persuasive. "I'm not going to die of this tonight. The bleeding's almost stopped already, and besides, do you know what ERs are like on Friday night? Drunks on parade. First thing Saturday morning would be lots better." He's grinning at her now, that delighted, "honey, I'm hip" grin that almost demands you grin back. And she tries not to, but this is a battle she's losing. "Besides, all the Landons are fast healers. We had to be. I'm going to show you just what to do." "You act like you've put your hand through 12 greenhouse windows." "No," he says, the grin faltering a little. "Never poked a greenhouse until tonight. But I learned some stuff about being hurt. Paul and I both did."
"He was your brother?"
"Yeah, he's dead. Draw a basin of warm water, Lisi, okay? Warm, but not quite hot." She wants to ask him all kinds of questions about this brother. "Daddy told Paul and me over and over. She never knew he had. But this isn't the time." Nor will she hector him anymore about going to the emergency room, not just now. For one thing, if he agreed to go, she'd just have to drive him there, and she isn't sure she could do it. She's come over all shaky inside. And he's right about the bleeding. It's slowed way down. Thank God for small favors. Lisi gets her white plastic basin, Mammoth Mart, 79 cents, from under the sink and fills it with warm water. He plops his lacerated hand into it. At first she's okay. The tendrils of blood lazing their way to the surface don't bother her too much. But when he reaches in and begins to gently rub, the water goes pink and Lisi turns away, asking him why in God's name he's making the cuts bleed all over again like that. "I want to make sure they're clean," he says. "They should be clean when I go..." He pauses, then finishes. "To bed. I can stay here, can I? Please?" "Yes," she says, "of course you can." And thinks, that isn't what you were going to say. When he's finished soaking his hand, he pours out the bloody water himself so she won't have to do it,
then shows her his hand. Wet and gleaming, the cuts look less dangerous and yet somehow more awful, like crisscrossing fish gills with pink deepening to red inside them.
Can I use your box of tea, Lisi? I'll buy you another one, I promise. I've got a royalty check coming. Over 5 grand. My agent promises on his mother's honor. I told him it was news to me he had one.
That's a joke, by the way.
I know it's a joke. I'm not that dumb.
You're not dumb at all.
Scott, why do you want a whole box of tea bags?
Get it and find out.
She gets the tea. Still sitting on her stool and working with one-handed care, Scott fills the basin with more not-quite-hot water. Then he opens the box of Lipton tea bags.
Paul thought this up, he says excitedly.
It's a kid's excitement, she thinks.
Look at the neat model airplane I made all by myself. Look at the invisible ink I made with the stuff from my chemistry set.
He dumps the tea bags in, all 18 or so. They immediately begin staining the water a dull amber as they sink to the bottom of the basin.
It stings a little, but it works really, really good. Watch.
Really, really good, Lisi notes.
He puts his hand in the weak tea he has made, and for just a moment his lips skin back, revealing his teeth, which are crooked and a bit discolored.
Hurts a little, he says, but it works. It really, really works, Lisi.
Yes, she says.
It's bizarre, but she supposes it might actually do something about preventing infection or promoting healing or both.
Chucky Gendron, the short-order cook at the restaurant, is a big fan of the Insider, and she sometimes sneaks a look. Just a couple of weeks ago, she read an article on one of the back pages about how tea is supposed to be good for all sorts of things. Of course, it was on the same page as an article about Bigfoot bones being found in Minnesota.
Yes, I suppose you're right.
Not me, Paul.
He's excited, and all his color has come back. It's almost as if he never hurt himself at all, she thinks.
Scott jerks his chin at his breast pocket. Cigarette me, baby love.
Should you be smoking with your hand all...
Sure, sure.
So she takes his cigarettes out of his breast pocket and puts one in his mouth and lights it for him. Fragrant smoke, she will always love that smell, rises in a blue stack toward the kitchen's sagging, water-stained ceiling. She wants to ask him more about boules, blood boules in particular. She is starting to get a picture.
Scott, did your mom and dad raise you and your brother?
Nope. He's got the cigarette in the corner of his mouth and one eye squinted shut against the smoke.
Mama died having me. Daddy always said I killed her by being a sleepyhead and getting too big.
He laughs at this as though it's the funniest joke in the world, but it's also a nervous laugh, a kid's laugh at a dirty joke he doesn't quite understand.
She says nothing. She's afraid to.
He's looking down at the place where his hand disappears into the basin, which is now filled with blood-stained tea. He puffs rapidly on his Herbert Territon, and the ash grows long. His eye is still squinted shut, and it makes him look different somehow. Not like a stranger, exactly, but different. Like, oh, say, like an older brother, one who died.
But Daddy said it wasn't my fault I stayed asleep when it was time to come out. He said she should have slapped me awake, and she didn't, so I grew too big, and she got killed for it. Booled end.
He laughs. The ash falls off the cigarette onto the counter. He doesn't seem to notice. He looks at his hand in the murky tea but says no more, which leaves Lisi in a delicate dilemma. Should she ask another question or not? She's afraid he won't answer, that he'll snap at her. He can snap, this she knows. She has audited his modern seminar on occasion. She's also afraid he will answer. She thinks he will.
Scott? She says this very softly.
Hmm?
The cigarette is already 3/4 of the way down to what looks like a filter but is, on a Herbert Territon, only a kind of mouthpiece.
Did your daddy make boules?
Blood boules, sure. For when we didn't dare, or to let out the bad gunky. Paul made good boules. Fun boules. Like treasure hunts. Follow the clues. Boule, the end, and get a prize. Like candy or an RC.
The ash falls off his cigarette again. Scott's eyes are on the bloody tea in the basin. But Daddy gives a kiss.
He looks at her and she suddenly understands he knows everything she has been too timid to ask and is answering as well as he can, as well as he dares. That's Daddy's prize, a kiss when the hurting stops. 19. She has no bandage in her medicine cabinet that will satisfy her, so Lisi ends up tearing long strips from a sheet. The sheet is old, but she mourns its passing just the same, on a waitress's salary, supplemented by niggardly tips from the Lost Boys and only slightly better ones from the faculty members who lunch at Pat's. She can ill afford to raid her linen closet. But when she thinks of the crisscrossing cuts on his hand and the deeper, longer gill on his forearm, she doesn't hesitate. Scott's asleep almost before his head hits the pillow on the side of her ridiculously narrow bed. Lisi thinks she will be awake for some time, mulling over the things he's told her. Instead, she falls asleep almost at once. She wakes twice during the night, the first time because she needs to pee. The bed is empty. She sleepwalks to the bathroom, hiking the oversized University of Maine t-shirt she sleeps in to her hips as she goes, saying, "Scott, hurry up, okay? I really have to go." But when she enters the bathroom, the nightlight she always leaves burning shows her an empty room. Scott isn't there. Nor is the toilet seat up, the way he always leaves it after he takes a whiz. All at once, Lisi no longer has to urinate. All at once, she's terrified that pain has awakened him. He's remembered all the things he's told her, and has been crushed by, what do you call them in Chucky's Insider? Recovered memories. Are they recovered? Or things he's just been keeping to himself? She doesn't know for sure, but she does know that childish way he spoke for a while was very spooky. And suppose he's gone back down to Park's greenhouse to finish the job. His throat this time instead of his hand. She turns toward the dim maw of the kitchen. The apartment consists of only that and the bedroom, and catches sight of him curled up in bed. He's sleeping in his usual semi-fetal position, knees almost to his chest, forehead touching the wall. When they leave this place in the fall, there will be a faint but discernible mark there, Scott's mark. She has told him several times that he'd have more room if he slept on the outside, but he won't. Now he shifts a little, the springs squeak, and in the glow of the streetlight coming in the window, Lisi can see a dark wing of hair fall across his cheek. He wasn't in bed. But there he is, on the inside. If she doubts, she could put her hand under the sheaf of hair she's looking at, lift it, feel its weight. So maybe I just dreamed he was gone? That makes sense, sort of. But as she goes back into the bathroom and sits down on the toilet, she thinks again, he wasn't there. When I got up, the smucking bed was empty. She puts the ring up after she's finished, because if he gets up in the night, he'll be too asleep to do it. Then she goes back to bed. She's in a doze by the time she gets there. He's beside her now, and that's what matters. Surely that's what matters. 20. The second time, she doesn't wake up on her own. Lisi. It's Scott, shaking her. Lisi. Little Lisi. She fights it. She put in a hard day, hell, a hard week, but he's persistent. Lisi, wake up. She expects morning light to lance her eyes, but it's still dark. Scott, is it? She wants to ask if he's bleeding again, or if the bandage she put on has slipped, but these ideas seem too big and complicated for her fogged-out mind. His it will have to do. His face is looming over hers, completely awake. He looks excited, but not dismayed or in pain. He says, "We can't go on living like this." That wakes her up most of the way, because it scares her. What is he saying? That he wants to break up? Scott? She fumbles on the floor, comes up with her Timex, squints at it. It's 4:15 in the morning. Sounding put out, sounding exasperated, and she is those things, but she is also frightened. Lisi, we should get a real house. Buy it. He shakes his head. Nah, that's backwards. I think we ought to get married. Relief floods her, and she slumps back. The watch falls from her relaxing fingers and clatters to the floor. That's all right. Timexes take a licking and keep on ticking. Relief is followed by amazement. She has just been proposed to, like a lady in a romance novel. And relief is followed by a little red caboose of terror. The guy doing the proposing, at 4:15 in the morning, mind you, is the same guy who stood her up last night, tore the shit out of his hand when she yelled at him about it, and a few other things, yeah, okay, true. Then came up the lawn holding the wounded hand out to her like some kind of smucking Christmas present. This is the man with the dead brother she only found out about tonight, and the dead mother that he supposedly killed because he, how did the hotshot writer put it? Growed too big. Lisey? Shut up, Scott, I'm thinking. Oh, but it's hard to think when the moon is down and the hour is none, no matter what your trusty Timex may say. I love you, he says mildly. I know. I love you too. That's not the point. It might be, he says. That you love me, I mean. That might be exactly the point. No one's loved me since Paul. A long pause. And Daddy, I guess. She gets up on her elbow. Scott, lots of people love you. When you read from your last book, the one you're writing now, she wrinkles her nose. The new one is called Empty Devils, and what she's read of it and heard him read from it, she doesn't like. When you read, nearly 500 people showed up. They had to move you from the main lounge into Hawk Auditorium. When you were done, they gave you a standing O. That's not love, he says. That's curiosity. And just between me and thee, it's freak show stuff. When you publish your first novel at 21, you find out all about freak show stuff, even if the damn thing only sells to libraries and there's no paperback. But you don't care about the child prodigy stuff, Lisey. Yes, I do. Wholly awake now, or almost. Yes, but cigarette me, baby love. His cigarettes are on the floor in the turtle ashtray she keeps for him. She hands him the ashtray, puts a cigarette in his mouth, and lights it for him. He resumes. But you also care about whether or not I brush my teeth. Well, yeah. And if the shampoo I'm using is getting rid of my dandruff or just causing more of it. That reminds her of something. I bought a bottle of that Tegrin stuff I told you about. It's in the shower. I want you to try it. He bursts out laughing. See? See? A perfect example. You take the holistic approach. I don't know that word, she says, frowning. He stubs out the cigarette, 1/4 smoked. It means that when you look at me, you see me top to bottom and side to side, and to you everything weighs the same. She thinks about it, then nods. I suppose, sure. You don't know what that's like. I put in a childhood when I was one thing. The last 6 years, I've been another. It's a better thing, but still, to most people around here and back at Pitt, Scott Landon is nothing but a holy jukebox. Put in a couple of bucks, out comes a smucking story. He doesn't sound angry, but she senses he could become angry, in time, if he doesn't have a place to go and be safe, be right-sized. And yes, she could be that person. She could make that place. He could help her do it. To some extent, they have done it already. You're different, Lisey. I knew it the first time I met you. On blues night in the main lounge, do you remember? Jesus Mary and Jojo the Carpenter, does she remember? She had gone up to the university that night to look at the Hartgen art exhibition outside Hawk, heard the music coming from the lounge, and went in on what was little more than a whim. He came in a few minutes later, looked around at the mostly full house, and asked if the other end of the couch she was sitting on was taken. She had almost skipped the music. She could have made the 8:30 bus back to Cleves if she'd skipped it. That was how close she'd come to being in bed alone tonight. The thought makes her feel the way looking down from a high window makes her feel. She says none of this, only nods. To me, you're like... He pauses, then smiles. His smile is divine, crooked teeth and all. You're like the pool where we all go down to drink. Have I told you about the pool? She nods again, smiling herself. He hasn't, not directly, but she's heard him talk about it at his readings and during the lectures she's audited at his enthusiastic invitation, sitting way at the back of the Boardman 101 or Little 112. When he talks about the pool, he always reaches out, as if he'd put his hands in it if he could, or pull things, language fishies maybe, out of it. She finds it an endearing boyish gesture. Sometimes he calls it the myth pool, sometimes the word pool. He says that every time you call someone a good egg or a bad apple, you're drinking from the pool or catching tadpoles at its edge. That every time you send a child off to war in danger of death because you love the flag and have taught the child to love it too, you are swimming in that pool, out deep, where the big ones with the hungry teeth also swim. I come to you and you see me whole, he says. You love me all the way around the equator and not just for some story I wrote. When your door closes and the world's outside, we're eye to eye. You're a lot taller than me, Scott. You know what I'm saying. She supposes she does, and she's too moved by it to agree in the dead of night to something she might regret in the morning. We'll talk about it tomorrow, she says. She takes his smoking gear and puts it on the floor again. Ask me then if you still want to. Oh, I'll want to, he says with perfect confidence. We'll see. For now, go back to sleep. He turns on his side. He's lying almost straight now, but as he begins to drift, he'll begin to bend. His knees will come up toward his narrow chest and his forehead, behind which all the exotic storyfish swim, will go to the wall. I know him. I'm beginning to know him, at least. At this, she feels another wave of love for him, and has to close her lips against dangerous words, the kind that are hard to take back once they have been spoken. Maybe impossible. She settles for pressing her breasts to his back and her stomach to his naked bottom. A few late crickets sing outside the window, and Pluto goes on his barking way through another night shift. She begins to drift away again. Lisi? His voice is almost coming from another world. I know you don't like devils. Hate it, she manages, which is as close as she can come to a critical appraisal in her current state. She is drifting, drifting, drifting away. Yeah, and you won't be the only one. But my editor loves it. He says the folks at Sailor House have decided it's a horror novel. That's fine by me. What's the old saying? Call me anything you want, just don't call me late to dinner. Drifting, his voice coming down a long, dark corridor. I don't need Carson Foray or my agent to tell me Empty Devils is going to buy a lot of groceries. I'm done screwing around, Lisi. I'm on my way, but I don't want to go alone. I want you to come with me. Shut up, Scott. Ghostly. She doesn't know if he goes to sleep or not, but for a wonder, for a blue-eyed wonder, Scott Landon does indeed shut up. 21. Lisi DeBuscher awakens on Saturday morning at the impossibly luxurious hour of 9 o'clock, and to the smell of frying bacon. Sunshine lies across the floor in the bed in a brilliant stripe. She goes out to the kitchen. He's frying bacon in his underpants, and she's horrified to see that he's removed the bandage she so carefully applied. When she remonstrates, Scott tells her simply that it itched. Besides, he says, holding his hand out to her, this reminds her so much of how he came walking out of the shadows last night that she has to repress a shiver. It doesn't look so bad in the light of day, does it? She takes his hand, bends over it as if she means to read his palm, and looks until he pulls away, saying if he doesn't turn the bacon it will burn. She isn't astounded, isn't amazed. Those are emotions perhaps reserved for dark nights and shadowy rooms, not for sunshiny weekend mornings with the Philco in the window playing that lowrider song she's never understood but always liked. Not astounded, not amazed, but she is perplexed. All she can think is that she must have believed the cuts were a hell of a lot worse than they actually turned out to be, that she panicked. Because these wounds, while not exactly scratches, are far from as serious as she thought. They've not only clotted over, they've started scabbing over. If she'd taken him to the Dairy Home ER, they probably would have told her to get lost. All the Landons are fast healers. We had to be. Meanwhile, Scott's forking crisp bacon out of the pan and onto a double fold of paper towels. As far as Lisi's concerned, he may be a good writer, but he's a great fry cook. At least when he really sets his mind to it. He needs new underwear, though. The seat of this pair sags rather comically, and the elastic waistband is on life support. She'll see what she can do about getting him to buy new ones when the royalty check he's been promised comes in. And of course, underwear isn't what's on her mind, not actually. Her mind wants to compare what she saw last night, those deep and sickening gills, pink shading to liverish red, with what's on offer this morning. It's the difference between mere cuts and gashes. And does she really think that anyone heals that fast, outside of a Bible story? Does she really? It wasn't a window pane he stuck his hand through, after all. It was a pane of greenhouse glass, which reminds her they'll have to do something about that. Scott will have to. Lacey. She's jerked out of her reverie to find herself sitting at the kitchen table, nervously knitting her t-shirt together between her thighs. What? One egg or two? She considers it. Two, I guess. Over easy or want 'em looking at you? Over, she says. Will we marry? He asks in exactly the same tone, cracking both eggs in his good right hand and dropping them into the pan, kerplunk. She smiles a little, not at his matter-of-fact tone, but at the faintly archaic turn of phrase, and realizes she's not surprised at all. She has expected this. This, what do you call it, this resumption. Must have been turning his proposal over in some deep part of her mind, even as she slept. Are you sure? She asks. Sure shot, he says. What do you think, baby love? Baby love thinks that sounds like a plan. Good, he says. That's good. He pauses. Then, thank you. For a minute or two, neither of them says anything. On the windowsill, the old cracked Philco plays the sort of music Dad DeBuscher never listened to. In the pan, the eggs snap. She's hungry, and she's happy. In the fall, she says. He nods, reaching for a plate. Good. October? Maybe too soon. Say right around Thanksgiving. Are there any eggs left for you? There be one and one be all I want. She says, I won't marry you if you don't buy some new underwear. He doesn't laugh. Then I'll make it a priority. He puts the plate in front of her, bacon and eggs. She is so hungry. She starts in and he cracks the last egg into the pan. Lisa Landon, he says. What do you think?
I think it's a keeper.
It's, what do you call it when all the words start with the same sound?
Alliteration.
Yeah, that. Now she says it. Lisa Landon. Like the eggs, it tastes good. Little Lisi Landon, he says, and flips his egg in the air. It turns over twice and lands square in the bacon grease, splat. Do you, Scott Landon, promise to strap it on and keep the mother smucker strapped? She asks. Strapped in sickness, strapped in health, he agrees, and they begin laughing like mad bastards while the radio plays in the sunshine. 22. With Scott, she always laughed a lot. And a week later, the cuts on his hand, even the one on his forearm, were pretty much healed. They didn't even scar. 23. When Lisi wakes again, she no longer knew when she was, then or now. But enough of morning's first light had crept into the room so she can see the cool blue wallpaper and the seascape on the wall. So it was Amanda's bedroom, and that seemed right. But it also seems wrong. It seems to her that this is a dream of the future she's having in her narrow apartment bed, the one she still shares with Scott on most nights, and will until the wedding in November. What wakened her? Amanda was turned away from her, and Lisi was still fitted against her like a spoon, her breasts against Manda's back, her belly against Manda's scant bottom. And just what has wakened her? She doesn't need to pee, not badly anyway, so what? Amanda, did you say something? Do you want something? Drink of water, maybe? Piece of greenhouse glass to slit your wrists with? These things passed through her mind, but Lisi didn't really want to say anything because an odd idea has come to her. The idea is that, although she can see the rapidly graying mop of Amanda's hair and the frill around the neck of Amanda's nightgown, she was actually in bed with Scott. Yes. That at some point in the night, Scott has... what? Crept through the lens of Lisi's memories and into Amanda's body? Something like that. It's a funny idea, all right, and yet she doesn't want to say anything, because she's afraid that if she did, Amanda might answer in Scott's voice. And what would she do then? Would she scream? Would she scream to wake the dead, as the saying is? Surely the idea is absurd, but look at her. Look how she's sleeping, with her knees pulled up and her head bent. If there was a wall, her forehead would be touching it. No wonder, you think. And then, in that pre-dawn ditch of 5 o'clock, with her face turned away so Lisi cannot see it, Amanda spoke. Baby, she says. There is a pause. Then, baby love. If Lisi's interior temperature seemed to drop 30 degrees the evening before, now it seems to drop 60. For although the voice which spoke the word was undeniably female, it is also Scott's. Lisi lived with him for over 20 years. She knows Scott when she hears him. This is a dream, she told herself. That's why I can't even tell if it's then or now. If I look around, I'll see the Pillsbury's Best magic carpet floating in the corner of the room. But she couldn't look around. For a long time, she couldn't move at all. What finally impels her to speak is the strengthening light. Night is almost over. If Scott has come back, if she was really awake and not just dreaming this, then there must be a reason, and it wouldn't be to harm her, never to harm her. At least, not on purpose. But she finds she can speak neither his name nor Amanda's. Neither seems right. Both seemed wrong. She saw herself grabbing Amanda's shoulder and rolling her over. Whose face would she see under Amanda's graying bangs? Suppose it was Scott's. Oh, sweet God, suppose. Daylight is coming, and she was suddenly sure that if she let the sun come up without speaking, the door between the past and the present will close and any chance of getting answers will be gone. Never mind the names, then. Never mind just who the hell is inside the nightgown. Why did Amanda say Boole? She asked. Her voice in the bedroom, still dim but brightening, brightening, sounds hoarse, dusty. I left you a Boole, remarks the other person in the bed, the person against whose bottom Lisi's belly lies. Oh God, oh God, oh God, this is the bad gunky, if ever there was bad gunky, this is it. And then, get hold of yourself. You strap it the fuck on. Do it right now. Is it? Her voice was drier and dustier than ever, and now the room seems to be brightening too fast. The sun will clear the eastern horizon any second now. Is it a blood Boole? You have a blood Boole coming, the voice tells her, sounding faintly regretful. And oh, it sounds so much like Scott. Yet now it sounded more like Amanda, too, and this scared Lisi more than ever. Then the voice brightened. The one you're on is a good Boole, Lisi. It goes behind the purple. You've already found the first 3 stations. A few more, and you'll get your prize. What's my prize? She asks. A drink. The reply was prompt. A Coke? An RC? Be quiet. We want to watch the Hollyhocks. The voice spoke with strange and infinite longing. And what is familiar about that? Why does it seem like a name for something instead of just bushes? Is it another thing that's hidden behind the purple curtain which sometimes keeps her own memories away from her? There was no time to think about it, let alone ask about it, because a slant of red light fingered in through the window. Lisi felt time come back into focus, and frightened as she had been, she felt an intense pang of regret. When is the blood pool coming? She asked. Tell me that. There was no answer. She knew there would be no answer, and still her frustration grew, filling the place where her terror and her perplexity had been before the sun seeped over the horizon, casting its dispelling rays. When is it coming, damn you, when? She was shouting now and shaking the white nightgown shoulder hard enough to make the hair flop, and still no answer. Lisi's fury broke.
Don't tease me like that, Scott. When?
This time she yanked on the nightgown shoulder, instead of just shaking, and the other body on the bed rolled limply over. It was Amanda, of course. Her eyes were open and she still breathed. There was even some dull color in her cheeks. But Lisi recognized that thousand-yard stare from Big Sis Amanda Bunny's other breaks with reality. And not only hers. Lisi no longer had any idea if Scott had actually come to her, or if she had only been fooling herself while in a semi-waking state. But of one thing she was quite sure. At some point during the night, Amanda had gone away again. This time maybe for good. Part 2. Soweza. She turned and saw a great white moon looking at her over the hill, and her breast opened to it. She was cleaved like a transparent jewel to its light. She stood filled with the full moon, offering herself. Her two breasts opened to make way for it, her body opened wide like a quivering anemone, a soft, dilated invitation. Touched by the moon. D.H. Lawrence, The Rainbow. Chapter 5. Lisi and the Long, Long Thursday. Stations of the Bool. 1. It didn't take Lisi long to realize this was far worse than Amanda's three previous breaks with reality, her periods of passive semicatatonia, to use the shrink's phrase. It was as if her usually irritating and sometimes troublesome sister had become a large breathing doll. Lisi managed, with considerable effort, to tug Amanda into a sitting position and swivel her around so she was sitting on the edge of the bed, but the woman in the white cotton nightgown, who might or might not have spoken in the voice of Lisi's dead husband a few moments before dawn, would not respond to her name when it was spoken or called or shouted, almost desperately, into her face. She only sat with her hands in her lap, looking fixedly at her younger sister. And when Lisi stepped away, Amanda looked fixedly into the space where she had been. Lisi went into the bathroom to wet a cloth with cold water, and when she came back, Amanda had subsided into a prone position again, with her upper half on the bed and her feet on the floor. Lisi began to pull her back up, then stopped when Amanda's buttocks, already close to the bed's edge, began to slide. If she persisted, Amanda would end up on the floor. Amanda Bunny. No response to the childhood nickname this time. Lisi decided to go whole hog.
Big Sis Amanda Bunny.
Nothing. Instead of being frightened, that would come shortly, Lisi was swept by the sort of rage Amanda had hardly ever been able to provoke in her younger sister when she had actually tried.
Stop this. Stop it and scoot your ass back on the bed so you can sit up.
Zip. Zero. She bent, wiped Amanda's expressionless face with the cold washcloth, and got more nothing. The eyes didn't blink even when the washcloth passed over them. Now Lisi did begin to be scared. She looked at the digital clock radio beside the bed and saw it had just gone 6. She could call Darla, with no worries of waking Matt, who would be sleeping the sleep of the just up in Montreal, but she didn't want to do that. Not yet. Calling Darla would mean the same as admitting defeat, and she wasn't ready to do that. She circled the bed, grabbed Amanda under the armpits, and hauled her backward. It was harder to do than she expected, given Amanda's scrawny bod. Because she's dead weight now, baby love, that's why. Shut up, she said, with no idea who she was talking to. Just shut it. She got on the bed herself with her knees on either side of Amanda's thighs and her hands planted on either side of Amanda's neck. In this position, that of the lover superior, she could look directly down into her sister's upturned, staring face. During Amanda's previous breaks, she had been biddable, almost the way a person under hypnosis is biddable, Lisi had thought at the time. This seemed very different. She could only hope it wasn't, because there were certain things a person had to do in the morning. If that was, the person wanted to go on living a private life in her little Cape Cod home. Amanda, she yelled down into her sister's face. Then, for good measure and feeling only slightly ridiculous, it was only the two of them after all.
Big, Sissa, Manda, Bunny, I want you to stand up. Stand up and go into the shithouse and use the toity. Use the toity, Manda Bunny, on three. One and two and three.
On three, Lisi again yanked Amanda to a sitting position, but Amanda still wouldn't stand. Once, at around 6:20, Lisi actually got her off the bed and into a kind of half-assed crouch. She felt the way she had when she'd had her first car, a 1974 Pinto, and after 2 endless minutes of grinding the starter, the motor would finally catch and run just before the battery died. But instead of straightening up and letting Lisi lead her into the bathroom, Amanda fell back onto the bed, fell crooked too, so that Lisi had to lunge, catch her under the arms, and shove her, cursing, to keep her from going on the floor.
You're faking, you bitch,
she shouted at Amanda, knowing perfectly well that Amanda wasn't.
Well, go on. Go on and...
She heard how loud she'd gotten. She'd wake up Mrs. Jones across the road if she didn't look out, and made herself lower her voice.
Go on and lie there.
Yeah.
But if you think I'm going to spend the whole morning dancing attendance around you, you're full of shite. I'm going downstairs to make coffee and oatmeal. If any of it smells good to your royal majesty, give me a holler. Or, I don't know, send down your smucking footman for takeout.
She didn't know if it smelled good to Big Sis Amanda Bunny, but it smelled fine to Lisi, especially the coffee. She had one cup of straight black before her bowl of oatmeal, and another with double cream and sugar afterward. Sipping that one, she thought,
all I need now is a ciggy and I could ride this day like a pony. A smucking Salem light.
Her mind tried to turn toward her dreams and memories of the night just past. Scott and Lisi, the early years, for sure, she thought. And she wouldn't let it. Nor would she let it try to examine what had happened to her on waking. There might be time later to think about it, but not now. Now she had Big Sissa to deal with. And suppose Big Sissa's found a nice pink disposable razor on top of the medicine cabinet and decided to slit her wrists with it, or her throat. Lisi got up from the table in a hurry, wondering if Darla had thought to clean the sharps out of the upstairs bathroom, or any of the upstairs rooms for that matter. She took the stairs at a near run, dreading what she might discover in the master bedroom, nerving herself to find nothing in the bed but a pair of dented pillows. Amanda was still there, still staring up at the ceiling. She appeared not to have moved so much as an inch. Lisi's relief was replaced by foreboding. She sat on the bed and took her sister's hand in her own. It was warm but unresponsive. Lisi willed Manda's fingers to close on her own, but they remained limp, waxy.
Amanda, what are we going to do with you?
There was no response. And then, because they were alone except for their reflections in the mirror, Lisi said,
Scott didn't do this, did he, Manda? Please say Scott didn't do it by, I don't know, by coming in?
Amanda said nothing one way or the other, and after a little while Lisi went prospecting in the bathroom for sharp objects. She guessed that Darla had indeed been here before her, because all she found was a single pair of nail scissors at the back of the lower drawer in Manda's small, not very vain vanity. Of course, even those would have been enough in a dedicated hand.
Why, Scott's own father.
Hush, Lisi, no, Lisi. All right, she said, alarmed by the panic that flooded her mouth with the taste of copper, the purple light that seemed to bloom behind her eyes, and the way her hand clenched on the tiny pair of scissors.
Okay, never mind, pass it.
She hid the scissors behind a clutch of dusty shampoo samples high up in Amanda's towel cupboard, and then, because she could think of nothing else, took a shower herself. When she came out of the bathroom, she saw that a large wet patch had spread around Amanda's hips and understood this was something the DeBuscher sisters weren't going to be able to work through on their own. She got a towel under Amanda's soaked bottom. Then she glanced at the clock on the night table, sighed, picked up the telephone, and dialed Darla's number. 2. Lisi had heard Scott in her head the day before, loud and clear. I left you a note, baby love. She dismissed it as her own interior voice mimicking his. Maybe it had been, probably had been. But by 3 o'clock on that long, hot Thursday afternoon, as she sat in Pop's Cafe in Lewiston with Darla, she knew one thing for sure. He'd left her one hell of a posthumous gift. One hell of a